You're listening to Office Hours, a series of curious conversations with Belfer Center experts. We sat down with Neil Ferguson, the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of History at Harvard University and author of Kissinger, 1923 to 1968, The Idealist. It's 5 o'clock on a Saturday. What are you doing?
Probably hanging out with one of my kids, most likely the youngest, Thomas.
What sort of stuff would you get up to?
We go for long walks in which we pretend to be characters in either Harry Potter or The Hobbit. He has a very vivid imagination.
Let me ask you a question. What is your favorite character to play as a Harry Potter
character? I quite like being Dumbledore, but there are also opportunities to be Snape, because Thomas has a, I think, healthy fascination with wicked characters. We do a lot of piracy as well, since we're reading Treasure Island at the moment together, so I get the chance to be Long John Silver. Thomas likes a cast of, if not thousands, certainly dozens, so I have to be quite...
You've got to be very, very good at acting.
I'm not good at acting, but at least I'm good enough for a 3.5-year-old, but don't ever ask me to do this.
Well, you already have the accent down, so, I mean, how much more is there to do?
Well, accents are key. I grew up in the west of Scotland in the 1960s and 70s. There was very little television, so we had to make our own entertainment. And the way
creative.
I and my friends entertained one another was essentially to impersonate first the teachers at our school and then a whole widening range of characters. It was a big thing in Britain in those days, accent. It still is. And that's how I entertain my children and sometimes my students.
Sometimes yourself, I imagine.
Yeah, when you're making when you're delivering lectures and making speeches, it's occasionally good for morale to slip into an amusing accent and give yourself a break from the west of Scotland burr, such as I still have left.
Hard questions are over.
Yeah, that was challenging.
Tough.
I haven't been asked about that stuff for a while.
So I want to get to the book you just released about a month ago, and I have it right here. It is called Kissinger, 1923 to 1968, The Idealist. And this puppy sits at 986 pages. Why couldn't you make it to 1,000?
Well, I could easily have made it to 1,000.
What did you leave out?
I cut to try and make the thing as readable as possible. I always write long and then cut, so it could quite easily have been longer than 1,000.
I mean, there are a lot of words in here. Is there one in there that you are particularly proud of using?
The Idealist. Well, Idealist.
The Idealist itself.
I'm giving it the subtitle, The Idealist, was partly a provocation designed to infuriate readers of the New York Times, but more seriously, it was intended to show that this book was going to say something quite new about the first half of Kissinger's life, something unexpected. And on the basis of years of research, this thing took about 10 years to do, I became convinced that his reputation as the arch realist, the sort of American Machiavelli, was wrong. So the thing that's exciting about the book for me is that it genuinely challenges received wisdom. And I think if you're writing a history book and saying something old, you probably are wasting your time. So this, I think, says something new.
Well, let's start with who Henry Kissinger is. Who is Henry Kissinger, and what are three reasons why we should care about him today?
Well, at 92 years old, he still remains an amazingly influential figure. If you follow his peregrinations. Right now, I think he's in China meeting with the senior leadership. That's the second time this year. So one reason to be interested in Henry Kissinger is that he continues to be an astonishingly influential player in the international system. Xi Jinping asked Kissinger to introduce him when he spoke to the giants of Silicon Valley in Seattle just a few weeks ago. Second reason is obviously that he's an historically significant character as national security advisor and Secretary of State to two presidents, Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford. He played an extremely important part in a key phase of the Cold War that we associate with the world détente. The third reason is that he remains one of the most controversial figures in modern American political history. In fact, I'm struggling to think of anybody whose reputation has been more fiercely fought over than Henry Kissinger. At one time, he was the hero of the US media, on the cover of Time magazine and Newsweek more than any other Secretary of State, Super K, in his cape and tights. And later he became reviled with extraordinary ferocity by my countryman Christopher Hitchens and others, who went so far as to accuse him of being a war criminal. That is a pretty contested reputation. And so from a historian's point of view, it represents a really interesting challenge.
What makes him so controversial? What were the reasons why people called him a war criminal?
That's by no means easy to answer. One point that I've tried to make in this first volume, and remember, this is the first half of his life.
This is the first 45 years of his life.
I still have volume two to write. Volume two includes the time in government. So I'm halfway there. I think part of the explanation is simply that the Nixon and Ford administrations were involved in some pretty difficult and nasty decisions, most obviously relating to the Vietnam War and its extension into Cambodia, but also relating to a bunch of other countries, not perhaps strategically of the first importance, but nevertheless countries where, for example, coups happened. Here we think of Chile, or extreme violence occurred in the case of Bangladesh. So there's a bunch of episodes which are and would be the stuff of controversy regardless of who had been in government at that time. But I think there's a reason why these episodes have attracted so much debate and so much polemical writing that's a little harder to explain. After all, plenty of administrations before and after the Nixon-Ford years were involved in, say, coup d'etat. I mean, there had been a whole bunch in the 1950s.
The Vietnam War preceded Kissinger's ascension to become national security advisor. Yet, for some reason, he has been this lightning rod.
Yes, I think lightning rod is the right term, because the Nixon administration became a lightning rod even before Watergate. For a generation that came of age in 1968, the student revolutionary generation, whose disgust and disillusionment with Vietnam reached a crescendo after the United States had really decided to liquidate the operation. I mean, if it were a fair world, all their anger would have been directed at the Johnson administration, maybe even the Kennedy administration, which had got the United States into the mess in the first place. But because of the way things work, there was a lag, and all the anger about Vietnam really vented itself against the administration that was trying to get the United States out. But there's another point which I think is really important here. There must be a connection between Kissinger's outsider status, the refugee, the Jew, that explains why he, unlike other secretaries of state, has been the target of so much hostility. Where, for example, is a book entitled The Trial of Dean Rusk? Why is it that other secretaries of state who've really done similar things, comparable things, don't get accused in this extraordinarily vitriolic way of war crimes? I think you have to understand a little bit more about the man to answer that question of why he became a lightning rod.
Is the childhood of Kissinger, the adolescence, the early years of Kissinger, critical in your eyes to understanding who he is today?
Well, a few people, I think, who work on education would dispute the importance of early childhood development. So it'd be odd for a biographer to skip over it. And one reason that he's played this down is that there was quite a bit of psychobabble written to the effect that, as a child, Kissinger witnessed the collapse of the Weimar Republic and this trauma made him wary of democracy. That sort of stuff got written in the 1970s and even more recently than that. And that's obviously nonsense, because he was nine when Adolf Hitler came to power in Germany. And I don't know about you, but at nine, I wasn't terribly politically sophisticated.
You might be surprised, I'm kidding.
Kissinger is, I think, probably not bluffing when he says, I was more interested in soccer than I was in the wider
And that's the stuff you focused
world.
On. You focused on more the day-to-day life of Kissinger as a kid.
The child is father to the man, and I wanted to understand this young man growing up, becoming a teenager in Nazi Germany, living in Fürth, right next to Nuremberg, one of the most Nazi towns in the whole of Germany. I wanted to understand a little bit about what that was like. But I do think, and I make this clear in the book, it's not the formative period. The formative period of his life is later, when he returns to Germany in a US Army uniform, 6 years after leaving. He leaves in 1938 and is back in Germany.
Fighting the people who he fled.
Yeah, fighting the Germans. And I think that experience, really 44 through to 47, when he returns from Germany and comes to this university, that's really, I think, the formative time. And I think the reason that he was dismissive of arguments that emphasized his childhood was precisely that. It's the young man who really has the searing experiences of war, of witnessing the Holocaust, and then also hunting down Nazis as a counterintelligence agent. I think those are much more important than those early teenage years when he clearly is aware of the discrimination. His father loses his job. He probably encounters some physical violence in the streets of Fürth. But those are not the formative experiences.
What can we learn from a different era? I mean, Henry Kissinger grew up, and even this moment you're talking about, the 1940s, is so different. It was so long ago, and it's so different from today.
I think what we can learn from studying this period is a lot about the importance of freedom and the way that people relate to freedom who have seen their freedoms removed and seen their relatives killed. I sometimes think that in much of the discussion that we have today, particularly I'm struck by this when I talk to my students, the memory of the Cold War has so much faded that we tend to forget that there was a Soviet Union which had a system of prison camps, the Gulag, that wasn't as horrific as the Nazi regime, but it was a lot closer to the Third Reich than it was to American democracy. And in that sense, it posed a meaningful menace, in addition to which this totalitarian regime was armed with nuclear weapons. And by the time Kissinger gets involved in government, it has achieved parity and is about to overtake the United States in terms of its nuclear capability. A book like this has to remind people of those fundamental realities of mid and late 20th century life.
Something that people call applied history. You, here at the Belfer Center, have worked a little bit to launch this program of applied history. Do you mind talking a little bit about that?
I and colleagues, Graham Allison, for example, have felt for some time that history is not as well integrated into our elite education as it should be. It has declined in the undergraduate program here relative to, say, economics or government, and it's a relatively poor relation within the Kennedy School. And I think that the project that is very dear to my heart is to give history an upgrade and make people realize that one studies the past with a view to understanding the present, and that indeed is a better way of understanding the present and potential futures than the rigid models that get designed by social scientists. So applied history is about understanding the historical process and developing a new methodology for understanding strategic problems, which is historical in nature. And that's different from social science. Let me just give you an example. Last semester, I set up a new course called Strategy and Crisis with Emil Simpson, who's an applied historian, if ever there was one, somebody who studied history but also fought in Afghanistan and in the British Army. And the point of this course was to try something different. We were going to look at strategic theories since Clausewitz, but we were also going to look at specific crises coming right up to the present, to Iraq and Afghanistan, and trying to encourage the students to see the power of analogy, the power and also the danger, showing that each crisis is understood by participants in terms of previous crises, and often not very well. So one of the things we're trying to do in applied history is to show people how you should use historical analogies. For example, is it true or false to say that extremist Islam or Islamic extremism, whichever formulation you prefer, poses a comparable threat to some of the ideologies of the mid-20th century, whether fascism or communism? That's an important question, because if it is similar, if it poses a similar threat, then maybe Islamic State is roughly where the Bolsheviks were before 1917.
What do you think?
I think it is. I mean, I think that's a good analogy, and I think if action is not taken to prevent Islamic State consolidating itself into a plausible caliphate, we may look back in 10 years' time and say we made exactly the same mistake when the Bolsheviks were close to power. We didn't successfully prevent them creating the most dangerous anti-Western empire of the 20th century, which was the Soviet Union.
What struck me maybe the most when I was reading Kissinger was that a lot of the time, maybe even most of the time, I felt I couldn't tell if you were telling a biography of Kissinger or writing a history of the times. Are those two inseparable?
They are inseparable, and I do that very deliberately, and I'm glad you spotted that. This book is long partly because it's long on context, and I make sure that at each step of the journey, the reader knows where he or she is. You really do understand, I hope, what it was like to be a Jew in Fürth in the 1930s, and also to be a refugee in New York in the late 1930s, and to be in a training camp in Louisiana, you know, getting your citizenship more or less at the same time as you're learning how to oil a rifle. I wanted to make each step of the journey intelligible in terms of its context. We do not just form as individuals in a vacuum. We are constantly being shaped by our surroundings and by the people we meet. There's a lot of contingency in Kissinger's life. It's kind of luck that he meets Kramer.
Fritz Kramer,
who becomes really a key mentor of his early life.
Who's also from Germany, is that right?
He was also from Germany, and as I show, this was a revelation, also of Jewish origin, although he did a good deal to cover that.
But he converted, right? His family
converted.
Well,
he played the part of a Prussian conservative when he came here. His father, who ultimately died in the Holocaust, was in fact a German nationalist, in many ways in flight from his Jewish origin. So it's a complicated story, but if Kissinger hadn't met Kramer as he was going through basic training, his life would have taken a completely different direction, because it was Kramer who said to him, no, you can't study accountancy at City College of New York. You have to go to Harvard or one of the Ivy League universities after the war, and you have to study history and philosophy. So at each turn, I think at the Harvard turn too, you have to see what this place was like. What was it like to arrive in 1947, having just come out of World War II on the GI Bill, and enter this kind of waspish place that was only beginning really to get its head around its new role as an international and very cosmopolitan institution with a substantial Jewish undergraduate and faculty body. So this is a story which I really enjoyed telling, because it helped me understand this place better. Understood Harvard much better after writing this book than I did before.
Yeah, because it's quite a remarkable story. I mean, the man, whether or not you agree with his policies, the man grew up in hyperinflation, Great Depression, fled the Nazis, fought the Nazis, stayed in Germany as a counterintelligence official, went back, started at Harvard, became a professor at Harvard, and almost, it seemed, out of nowhere, advising presidential nominees, or I should say, primary nominees.
And Near nominees.
Nelson Rockefeller, right. Near nominee.
Always the bridesmaid, never the bride, 60, never gets
64
the nomination.
And he was advising Rockefeller, opposing Nixon, and then Nixon appointed him to become national security. It almost felt out of nowhere, this man rocketed from being a Harvard professor to being the president's primary security advisor. He was a professor. How did he make that switch? What do professors know about government work? What could you possibly know about current affairs?
Well, there are two things going on here. One is that the Cold War was a time when Washington was hungry for academic expertise. Just think of how many...
The good old days.
Well, I'm not going to say it necessarily was good, because Kennedy, in particular, hires an enormous number of faculty members from Harvard to join his administration after he wins in 1960. It must be said that these Harvard professors did not necessarily cover themselves in glory. Vietnam became a disaster, partly because very well-educated people encouraged presidents, first Kennedy and then Johnson, to escalate U.S. involvement there. So let's not think of it as the good old days. Mm. But it was certainly a time when professors went more frequently to Washington, D.C. than perhaps is true now, although even today this still happens. Think of our colleague Samantha Power or Ash Carter. But there's something special in Kissinger's case that I think is crucial, and that is his leap from being somebody who worked on 19th century diplomatic history to being a public intellectual via a book called Nuclear Weapons and Foreign Policy, published in 1957.
And this was advocating limited use of nuclear weapons.
Correct.
Is that correct?
It's an interesting
Sounds
case.
Sounds controversial.
Right. So you're probably already thinking of Dr. Strangelove. Let me take the story in two steps. First, Kissinger struggled to get tenure at Harvard, and while he was struggling, got a job at the Council on Foreign Relations, which he preferred to going to Chicago, where he had an offer. So he goes to the CFR, and he essentially is rapporteur on a study group on nuclear weapons and U.S. strategy. Mm-hmm. He kind of takes it over and turns it into his own book, and takes full advantage of the expertise that the CFR's able to put in the room, and becomes becomes an expert on the issue, sufficiently to write this book. The second point, though, has to do with its argument. Now, the argument Kissinger made, which was indeed controversial, was that there ought to be some middle position between capitulation to the Soviets or blowing the world up. The Eisenhower administration had essentially a binary strategy. This was deliberate on Ike's part. The threat of massive retaliation was the principal weapon to contain Soviet aggression. The problem was that if the Soviets took little nibbles out of territory that the US didn't have a keen interest in, it was pretty hard to threaten massive retaliation. Kissinger's argument was that in that sense, the policy was rather advantageous to the Soviets and encouraged them to take these nibbles in what was then getting to be called the Third World. So this is not such a crazy argument.
Made it more of a credible threat.
Right, say, can we think of a situation in which we might use nuclear weapons without escalating to Armageddon? Now, interestingly, Kissinger becomes famous for this argument, is on TV, is being interviewed. Dr. Kissinger, do you seriously mean that we could limit the use of nuclear weapons?
Is that the best American impression you got?
It's the best I'm able to do after a very few hours of sleep. That's actually how they talked in the 1950s. You should watch more 50s TV. And Kissinger performs pretty well in these encounters, becomes, not a celebrity, but a public intellectual, is heard of in Washington. People read the book, including Eisenhower's staff, including Vice President Nixon. He himself later rose back and writes an article saying, on second thoughts, maybe it would be impossible to limit a nuclear war. But by then it's too late. The idea has a life of its own. A, he's famous. And B, the idea becomes an integral part of NATO doctrine for the rest of the Cold War. Otherwise, how do you explain the huge investment both sides make in battlefield nuclear weapons?
Power is the ultimate aphrodisiac. This is a quote of his. Is that something you think was because of his status or because it was Henry Kissinger? Or was it both?
Well, the key thing to that most famous of his sayings is that it's a joke. And a lot that Henry Kissinger became known for relates to his sense of humor, which I liken to the Groucho Marx sense of humor, in which you do self-deprecation through exaggeration. After he becomes Secretary of State, the journalists ask him, "And how should we address you from now on?" And he replies, "Well, I don't stand on ceremony. You can just call me Your Excellency." That's a very Groucho Marx line. And power as the ultimate aphrodisiac is really intended as self-deprecation. It's a way of saying, well, why on earth are these starlets willing to have dinner with me? Not exactly the most prepossessing looking man, and a little overweight for most of his adult life. So there's an important role here in the story for humor. One reason the press likes Kissinger, one reason the press corps has a kind of infatuation with him in the early 1970s is that he is quick-witted, and some of these lines are just entertainingly good. Then he's also playing to the press. Remember, the Nixon administration it has this extremely tense relationship with the mainstream media. Nixon's deeply suspicious, is convinced the New York Times is out to get him, not to mention the Washington Post, which ultimately does get him. Kissinger, on the other hand, actually is quite adept at cultivating the press corps. So the Super K period, which I suppose culminates when he shows up at the premiere of The Godfather with Ali McGraw on his arm, it's interesting. It's a sort of it's a deliberate cultivation of the press by Kissinger for his own purposes.
Right. You said there's somebody. So he had a reputation of being something of a ladies' man. But one of the things you say is that, no, he wasn't a ladies' man. He was a ladies' man.
Yeah.
There was somebody out there, and this was something of a front.
It was a front. I mean, these dinners, which attracted the interest of the gossip columnists, did not end in torrid sex scenes. I'm sorry to disappoint viewers, because he would usually go back to the State Department after dinner, and in fact turns out to have been in a steady relationship with the woman who became his second wife, Nancy McGuinness, a relationship that was completely below the radar for nearly 10 years, because they met in 1964, were clearly in a relationship by the mid-60s, but it's not actually in the news until shortly before they get married. So there was a pretty successful management of the media here, which I think relates to the fact that his first marriage broke up when his kids were very young, and he really didn't want the new relationship to be in the public eye, nor did Nancy McGuinness. So this means that you have this kind of facade of the secret swinger, not so secret.
That's what he called himself,
yeah,
is that right?
Another of the many lines that the right. press absolutely loved. Think of me as a secret swinger. So the sort of joking around about a Secretary of State who goes to Hollywood and attends movie premieres. I mean, this of course the media ate up. It was in such contrast to the doer and dark figure who was president at that time.
Before we move on, I want to ask one more quick question about the book, and this is about the title, the word idealist that you used. You referenced it, you alluded a little bit to it earlier, about what you mean by idealist. Does it mean that he is a morally upstanding guy? What does idealist mean? What is it really?
So the term has, I think, applicability in at least three senses. First, his own experience made him wary of self-styled realists. There's an interview.
What are realists?
Realists, in other words, let's just spell out the dichotomy in discussions of U.S. foreign policy. There are the idealists who believe in Woodrow Wilsonian notions of international law and self-determination of nations, principles of the sort that Wilson enunciated during and after the First World War. And the realists say, oh, the heck with that, let's just follow our national interests. And there's a sort of sub-clause which says, and we'll do whatever it takes to advance those national interests, and it may not always be very pretty. So realism in that sense means we leave our ideological considerations aside and we will follow the national interest and we will do whatever it takes. We'll be inspired by Bismarck, if not Machiavelli. Now, most people assume that that is Kissinger and that he in many ways is the sort of exemplar in the United States of a realism that is almost amoral and indeed, some would argue, immoral. What I've tried to show in this book is that in the first half of his life, that description really doesn't fit. A, because he saw the failed foreign policies of the 1930s that we call appeasement as an example of realism gone wrong. And he says in an interview in the 1950s, the appeasers thought that they were tough realists. That's not intended as a compliment.
That's right.
Secondly, all the work he did as an undergraduate on the philosophy of Immanuel Kant made him, I think, an idealist in the strict philosophical sense. The senior thesis is really a meditation on Kant and the nature of freedom and how far we really have freedom, how far we experience
freedom to think.
Freedom to choose.
Freedom to choose.
And it's in particular the notion that one experiences freedom through choice that Kissinger comes of age as a philosopher.
Something like a perception of reality, right? Isn't that?
Well, that's the third piece.
Okay.
If you imagine the time when he is delving into Kant, idealism is not at all fashionable. Pragmatism is the dominant strain in American philosophy. That had been the case at Harvard for decades. And there's also rampant materialism in the world. Marxism-Leninism rules the roost in the Soviet Union, and there are all these new economic determinists springing up in the United States who say the Cold War is just about rival economic systems, and the most efficient or more efficient one will win. Kissinger says, no. This is not what the Cold War is about. The Cold War is about ideas and ideals, and we should reject totalitarianism, he says, even if it is more economically efficient, because the ideal of freedom is more important than economic efficiency. And if we try to win on economic efficiency, we will lose because the Cold War's about something higher than that. But that's the sense in which he's an idealist. And I think it leads naturally into a series of positions he takes. For example, when he's in the Kennedy administration as a sort of part-time advisor to Kennedy, on almost all the issues of that time, the Berlin crisis in 61, then the Cuban Missile Crisis the following year, and early Vietnam, the young Kissinger takes the idealist position and sees Kennedy as doing dirty realist deals with the Soviets. Now, that's the sense in which he's an idealist. Now, that is the subtitle of Volume 1. It is not going to be the subtitle of Volume 2. I don't know what the subtitle of Volume 2 will be, but there's clearly a fundamental transition when this man enters the service of Richard Nixon, because Nixon was many things, but he was not, by any stretch of the imagination, an idealist.
So I was wondering how you think about American power today. Where are we now? Where are we heading?
More than 10 years ago, I published a book called Colossus, The Rise and Fall of America's Empire, which argued that there was a fundamental problem with the project of the Bush administration to build states of a more congenial sort in Afghanistan and in Iraq. And the problem, I said, was that the United States really doesn't do empire well.
You think the United States is an empire?
Well, it is doing empire-like things. That's what invading Mesopotamia makes most historians think of, or for that matter, Afghanistan. It's engaged in empire-like activities throughout the Cold War. It's just that it insists it's not imperialism, just in the same way that the Soviets insisted that they weren't doing imperialism, even when they clearly were. So the part of the problem is just that it's very hard to do empire if you insist that you're not. But I identified three deficits, which I thought explained why things would go wrong in the 2000s, and I think the analysis held very good indeed, dangerous or not. One, I said, there's a manpower deficit. Not enough Americans want to go to hot, poor, dangerous places for more than about 6 months at a time. And that's pretty hard to sustain any state-building venture with 6 monthly rotations of a professional volunteer military. Two, there's a fiscal deficit. I've been banging on about this for more than 10 years. It's pretty hard to maintain the kind of commitments the US embarked on 10 years ago if you're under permanent pressure from your domestic programs like Social Security and especially Medicare. Those just ultimately crowd out defense spending given its more discretionary nature. And third, there's an attention deficit. And the American public loses interest in this stuff after roughly 4 years. And it's very hard indeed to get commitment from the public to any long-term undertaking like state building. So I think that argument has held pretty good. It was a good predictor of what would happen in Iraq. Fatigue did set in, fiscal constraints did become ultimately binding, and it was easy to predict, indeed I did predict it in 2007, that the next president would go in the opposite direction and try to reduce those commitments. And it was also easy to predict that that would be really hard, because pulling the United States out of the Middle East, or for that matter Afghanistan, would lead to greater instability in
those
places.
You see that as undermining our power even more, is that correct?
I think it's ultimately undermined stability in those regions. And the combination of the Bush and Obama administrations has been actually a pretty disastrous one, not just for what we call the Middle East, but for a huge stretch of territory across North Africa all the way to South Asia. So I think that critique, which I've been making in articles and in interviews for a decade, held pretty good. The thing I've learned from the Kissinger book is that there was a fourth deficit that I'd missed, and that was the history deficit. That American decision makers are, to a remarkable extent, uninterested in history and do not regard it as relevant to what they do. This, I suppose, I began to see in Washington on one of my occasional visits there, when I remember being told that the template for post-Saddam Iraq was post-communist Poland. And that was from an administration official who clearly had been to neither Poland nor Iraq. So I think I'm kind of coming around to the view that the US has a systemic problem in the way it educates its elites. Kissinger used to say in the 60s that there were too many lawyers in American government, and that lawyers are terrible at strategy because they just do things on a case-by-case basis. I'm sympathetic to that view, but I'd go further and say it's this lack of historical training that is really the problem. And it means that decision makers approach complex challenges, whether it's Iraq or more recently Syria, without really the necessary background knowledge. And that's something that applied history, if we can make it take off and fly here at Harvard, is designed to correct.
China's rise. Do you see war with China as inevitable?
No.
Why not?
No, because things in history generally aren't inevitable. I'm not of the view that there is a sort of Thucydides' trap waiting to claim China and the United States the way it claimed Britain and Germany 100 years ago. I'm skeptical of that because it seems to me history is just too complex to reduce to such simple covering laws. US-China relations need not lead to conflict any more than relations between the United States and the United Kingdom led to conflict, even when they were clearly rivals in the late 19th and much of the 20th century. Now, there are big cultural similarities and big cultural differences, so the two cases can't be exactly compared. But here I side with Kissinger's view that coevolution is preferable to confrontation. The United States does not have a credible strategy for containing, much less confronting, China. It seems to me that the most important relationship in the world for the past decade has been China-America. That was why I coined the word Chimerica. And nobody in their right mind wants this relationship to turn into a confrontational one, much less into outright conflict. And I would say the probability of there being a kind of Sino-American war in our lifetimes is vanishingly small. It's not zero, though. And one has to understand from history how relationships can lead from amity to war. Understanding that process, whether you study the origins of the First World War or the Second World War, is, I think, an absolutely crucial part of what applied history is about. And if I've done nothing else as a historian, I hope it's been to illuminate the complexity of those processes. There was nothing inevitable about an Anglo-German war in 1890 or even 1913. It was one of those bolts from the blue, one of those complex systems producing an unexpected result that recur throughout history. We should bear that in mind and avoid simplifying history, because I think if we simplify it too much, we're all too likely to repeat past mistakes.
Christopher Ferguson, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.
Office Hours was produced by the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government.